Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and we will be commencing there in just a couple of minutes. Yesterday at church, someone said, "Well, I see that you're teaching the book of Ecclesiastes at Oakland this week." And then said, "Can you please tell me how you read the book of Ecclesiastes and not get depressed as you read it?" And I think if you don't get depressed when you read it, you've kind of missed the point of the book of Ecclesiastes. This is a book that is written in a very, very different style than what we find with most books of the Bible. And thus, as we approach it, we have to approach it a little bit differently. I think sometimes we tend to approach most any book of the Bible as we would a book of history, especially in the Old Testament. We look at a book and we try to figure out its chronology, and we try to look at it kind of in a linear fashion, that it's this event followed by this event followed by this event. And Ecclesiastes just doesn't fit that at all. In fact, very much like the books of poetry, what we find is that in some ways it's kind of like as you've got a picture and you are just putting little pieces of the picture together so that the end you can stand back and look at it and see what the writer is attempting to tell us. And so as we think about the book of Ecclesiastes, that's how we're going to approach it. Now let me just say this. As we think about the book itself, I think that especially as we get over toward the end of the book, that we find that it was a book that was written to influence those who are young. It is a book that needs to be studied when one is quite young. But yet, with that being said, I think it's a book that we understand better the older we get. You live a few years, and then you read these things that the writer is talking about, and all of a sudden you're nodding your head, and you're saying, "That's exactly right," because we have witnessed that firsthand. This book is a lot about life, and it's showing us that no matter what generation we live in, what we are doing is we're witnessing these same kinds of things over and over again. And so I would encourage us that no matter what age we are, as we look at this book, that we think about it from the standpoint of how it can change our lives, how it can change our view of life. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time with just the mechanics of the book. I will mention this, though, just in passing. There's a lot of debate on who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. You look at it, and there are clues that make it appear that Solomon wrote it. He talks about being king over Israel. He talks about things that would sound very much fitting with the life of Solomon. And indeed, it may very well be that Solomon wrote the book. The other line of thought is Solomon never uses his name. The name Solomon never comes up in the book. And when you read the last of the book of the life of Solomon, you see that he doesn't really seem to come to the same conclusion that the book of Ecclesiastes comes to. So I'm just going to tell you, I don't know who wrote the book. We could spend a lot of time debating that, whether it's Solomon, whether it's a king who followed Solomon, whether it's somebody who's kind of writing as though he is Solomon. Makes no difference whatsoever. The conclusion is still going to be the same. So as we look at the book, whoever is writing it is trying to give us a message, trying to tell us things that as we look at our lives, as we look at how the lives of mankind progress, we're going to find very similar outcomes. And one of the things that we find throughout the book is what is translated in English, the word vanity. The word in Hebrew, habel, actually would have more meaning to it than what we would limit to the word vanity. When we think about that term, we think about the idea of here is something that is useless, here is something that has no worth whatsoever, and very much that idea is expressed within the book. But I think it's a little bit broader in places. I think sometimes we do have that idea of meaningless, but we also have the idea of an enigma. The idea of how do we make sense of this? And so sometimes when we find that word translated, this is vanity, really what the writer is saying is, how do we make sense out of this as we look at mankind, as we look at how things are going? And so we need to pay attention to that, that always that word vanity, as we would think about it, would not exactly fit the theme that the writer is seeking to put down. But here is the idea. When we look at life under the sun, That phrase is going to keep coming up in the book, as you know, as you've read it and studied it before. That idea keeps coming up, and it's the idea of, as we look at life in the realm of leaving God out of the equation, as we look at life without God, here is our Habel. Here is our vanity, our meaninglessness, our enigma. The idea that God is not considered, but I want you to note as well, it's the idea where death is not considered. We'll be talking a lot about death this week. The book kind of takes your head and makes you focus in on death. Because what the writer is going to say is, humans don't want to look in that direction. We want to look in every other way besides that. But the writer is saying, when you rise above the sun, you got to focus on that. You got to understand that death is coming. And you've got to understand how you are going to stand when your death comes. And so that idea keeps cropping up. But primarily, when we look at that idea of life under the sun, the idea is, here we are trying to live without God. Here we are trying to live as we think about in the times of the Renaissance, where mankind becomes the center of creation. Humanism abounds. We are the center of everything that's important. That's vanity. That's life under the sun, and that's what the writer is going to keep telling us. Now, as we think about that idea, and we'll keep coming back to it throughout the week, we also want to understand how the book is actually set up. Now, there are any number of interpretations of how the book of Ecclesiastes was written. But I came across one by a writer named Daniel Estes. And I tell you, I was just so impressed with his work, because I think a lot of the way that he approached the book helps us to make more sense out of it. As we said earlier, it's not the idea of a linear study. It's not the idea where when we start in verse 1, we're following an uninterrupted thought till we get to chapter 12, to the end of the book. What we're seeing in this, though, is a series of where the writer is taking us in cycles. He's saying, let's think about life under the sun here. And he's going to finish that cycle. And he's going to pick it up again. And he's going to take us through cycle 2, and then cycle 3, and cycle 4. So in other words, we're looking at the same idea 4 times within the book. The writer's approaching it from a different direction. Sometimes he comes back to the same idea. But it's the idea that we're going through it 4 times, we're looking at this, and it basically follows the same pattern. What we'll see is that the writer here is going to give us a thesis. He's going to say at the beginning of each cycle, here's what I think. He's then going to progress, and he's going to give us observations by his experiences. I've lived it. I've tried to do it this way. And then finally, we'll come to the evaluation, where he'll say, after examining all of the evidence based on what I've looked at, here is the conclusion of the matter. And so we'll follow those. And this week, Lord willing, we're going to try to take a cycle each of the first 4 days. So through Thursday, we'll be looking at each cycle. Not in great detail, but kind of an overview of it, and note what the writer's telling us. And he's going to start off in chapter 1, and he's going to give us his provisional thesis of the book. You notice there what he says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. For what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Okay, here is the question we're trying to answer. What makes life worth living? What do we gain from all of this toil that we're putting into this life? Hey, and he's going to follow that idea throughout these 4 cycles until finally we come to his ultimate conclusion at the end of the book in chapter 12, picking up in verse 9. And the thing is, he's kind of going to give us hints toward that grand conclusion throughout. Each time we finish a cycle, he's going to hint, this is the direction I'm heading. This is what we're going to be looking at as we get to the end of the book, to the end of this grand journey that I'm making, is what the writer would tell us here. And so everything in between is going to link that provisional thesis, that first thesis that he gives, with the ultimate conclusion that, Lord willing, we'll look at on Friday as we see him reaching the high point of the book. All right, so all of that being said, let's break it down now into what is the purpose of the book of Ecclesiastes. Well, as we think about the book, it is depressing. Only if we're trying to live a life without God. That's what's depressing about it. You look at it, and if you're trying to live without God, you can say, this describes me perfectly. Everything he's saying is exactly right about my life and why it's so depressing. So really what he's doing is he's trying to destroy our confidence in ourselves. He's trying to break that completely down in our thoughts, in our actions. And I tell you, one thing he's going to hit is our righteousness, or so-called righteousness. Just like Jesus with the Pharisees, the writer of the book is going to try to hit at us and say, if you think that your righteousness, your self-righteousness, is what God desires, you've got to think again. And so all of that is going to be destroyed as we go through the book. And eventually what he's going to say is, you've got to replace all of that with a trust in God. That God is in control, that you may not understand everything God does, but God's got it under control. And you can rely on that, and you can be confident in that fact. And I think what we'll find is that everything fits in that. I came across this quote that I thought was very good and fitting with the purpose. I believe this was by Estes as well, who I referenced earlier. He said that mortals cannot peer beyond the veil that hides the purpose of God from human understanding. Consequently, they are overwhelmed with the meaninglessness of human expression. Someone says, I can't understand the ways of God, so I'm going to try to go it by myself. And the writer says, you'll never come to a good conclusion. You'll never reach a good understanding in your life about that. He wants us to see everything within the hands of God, whether we understand it or not, to develop the trust that everything God does, he's going to do right, and ultimately for our betterment, we're going to see that happen. Okay, now that's kind of our introduction to the book. So let's jump into it now, and the first part of the book that we find is kind of a prologue. If you imagined Ecclesiastes being written today, you would almost have it written as a prologue, and then the main section, and then an epilogue at the end, where he's getting us ready, he's then going through the cycles, and then he's going to tell us where we've been. And so as we think about this prologue that we find in the first 11 verses of the book of Ecclesiastes, what we find here is the idea of seeking to define what this vanity is all about. So as the writer sets us on this course, he's going to seek to define for us what this is all about. And what he's going to tell us is that this can really refer to both good and bad things that happen to mankind. Now that's kind of interesting, because you think, well, if it's vain, what's good about that? Well, throughout the book, he's going to tell us sometimes really good things happen to really rotten people. Someone who is just horrible, someone who doesn't care anything about God, he may have some very good things happen to him. Consequently, you've got someone who loves the Lord, someone who has been diligent, servant, and he may end up in a terrible consequence in his life. And so the writer is saying, if you try to piece all of this together without God, it's not going to make any sense whatsoever. It's going to be vanity. It's going to be that meaninglessness. So it's not necessarily just talking about all of the good things, or even necessarily all of the bad things. And so the writer is going to go on then to say, as you think about this idea, under the sun, there is very little that's going to determine when something good is going to happen to someone or when something bad is going to happen. Very little under the sun to determine who's going to live a good life, who's not going to live a good life. And that's what's going to drive the writer crazy in his search. As he looks through it, he's going to say, now wait a minute. Here's this guy who has been so good, and nothing good seems to be happening to him. And here's this guy over here, he's just a wretch. He's just a terrible man. And yet he's riding on the horse while someone else is leading his way. And so he's going to address those things. He's going to look at those things. And primarily, as we said, he's describing this life that's happening without God. All right, so let's put this in just very basic terms now. As the writer looks at life under the sun, he's saying it's very much like a hamster on a wheel. Now, my wife has never allowed rodents to be kept as pets, so we have no experience with hamsters, but you may have. What does that little hamster do for fun? He gets on his wheel and he spins. And where does he go? He always ends up at the same place, doesn't he? He's always going. And I don't know if the writer had any experience with hamsters and wheels or not, but what he's about to say is going to be a perfect description of that. But does that not sound like life to an extent? Have you ever felt that way? You know, you wake up in the morning and you start out the same way it's always started, and you go through the same thing you go through every day, and you finish the day like you always do, and you get up the next day and you start all over, and it's just this continuing kind of thing. Can you imagine how depressing that would be if you didn't have God in your life? Can you think about what a horrible existence it would be just to think, I'm going to get on this wheel every day, I'm going to end up doing the same thing every day, and it's not going to get me anywhere. Does that sound kind of vain and meaningless? That's exactly what the writer's trying to get us to understand. And he says, now, let's take God completely out of the equation. He says, let's look at this from the standpoint of someone who has no understanding about the Lord. And he says, if you're this way, even nature looks like the hamster on a wheel. Look down to verse 4 with me. He says, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. Listen to that. You know, we stand on the banks of the seashore and we're impressed with the creation of God. But now take God out of it. You stand on the seashore and you know that the waters of the earth are all pouring through the rivers and the streams and the creeks and ultimately reaching that. And it evaporates, and it comes back down as rain, and it starts all over again, and it goes through the cycle, and it goes back up in evaporation, and it starts all over again. And the wind blows one direction, and the wind blows another direction, and it makes its circuit, and it comes back around. And what's been accomplished in all of that? Under the sun would say, we are just stuck in a rut. The sun's going to come up, the sun's going to go down, the sun's going to come up tomorrow, the sun's going to go down tomorrow. And you just find yourself completely looking at nature as this completely vain, repetitious, cyclical process. And the writer says, that's what your life is like without God. That's what it is without God. He goes on to say as well, history has the same problem. He says, you look at mankind, we have the same problem. The latter part of verse 8, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after. And so we look at history, and every generation has the answer to life. Every generation has figured it out. Every generation has determined how we're never going to fight wars again, how we're going to cure all diseases, how we're going to do away with poverty. And that generation dies and the next one comes on, and they now have figured out how to keep us out of wars and how to make sure there's no poverty. Now we're going to fight all diseases, and that generation dies away. And the next generation has figured out how we're never going to fight wars again. You see that? You look at human history, and you think, without God, boy, this is sad. You've got all of these people, and their newness, their inventions are simply forgetting what's come before them. Now, the writer is not here making any kind of bold statement that that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had iPads. He's not saying that there is nothing new in the sense of inventions. What he's talking about is the ideas of mankind. He's saying there is nothing that you are thinking that a man has never thought before. When you think you have all the answers to life's problems, someone of the past generation had those same answers, and someone from the generation before that had the same answers. So basically, newness, according to the writer, is just simply forgetting history. It's forgetting your source. And so he says, as you look at nature, as you look at history, what you're finding here is that mankind under the sun is basically reinventing the wheel with every generation that comes around. Now, at that point, we should be pretty depressed. The writer is seeking to say to us, you leave God out of the picture, and it is a boring, repetitious, unmeaningful, vain life that you're living. Okay, and he set up the book at this point. Now remember, he's working toward that grand conclusion, but he's starting out saying, this is what life is like under the sun. Now, let's go ahead and move into this first cycle that we find, the first observation of life. And what we're going to find here is he's going to tell us several things that he's attempted to do to find some kind of meaning under the sun. Hey, this is his purpose. What he's seeking to do is to find a way that he can make some kind of sense of life without God. And so let's go ahead and pick up in verse 12 and we'll see that. He says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out wisdom by all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and all is striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. When I read passages like this, I oftentimes think of time travel shows. Have you ever watched a time travel show or movie, and someone is sent back in the past, and no matter what he does, he can't change the outcome? You know, he's trying so hard to change it, but everything just goes like it's always gone. That's what he's saying here. He's saying, I looked at all of these things, and I've tried to straighten out the crooked things, and I've tried to make crooked the straight things, and I can't. He's saying, what I'm looking at here is an unending cycle of things that mankind just continues to do, repeating those same mistakes, doing the same things over and over again, with the same consequence every time he does it. But nonetheless, what we're going to find is that he's going to do his best to figure this out. And so the remainder of this cycle is going to show us the steps that he went through to do this. So the writer, we could say then, is somewhat taking on the role of a scientist. This is his grand experiment. What he's going to do is he's going to make his observations. Then he's going to try to figure out a way that he, unlike any man who's ever come before him, can make sense of life under the sun, can determine something good about this. So let's look at the steps that he's going to follow here as he goes through this process. First thing he's going to do is he's going to experiment with wisdom. Now let me just pause here and make an observation about the book. Typically in the Bible, when we read about wisdom, it's a good thing. You read the book of Proverbs, and wisdom is presented in glowing terms. She is this lady who's pictured at the beginning of the book who you want to hear talk. And if you'll just listen, she's going to give you all the answers of life. Book of Proverbs presents wisdom above the sun. I want us to understand that. There's not a contradiction between these two books. Proverbs is wisdom when you are walking with God, when you're doing what God wants. Ecclesiastes is looking at wisdom under the sun. Wisdom in one of two ways, where you are trying to be wise without God, or you're trying to take God's wisdom and kind of jam it in to a... It's kind of like taking something round and trying to jam it into a square hole where it just doesn't work. And so the writer here is going to say, with wisdom, it's not always what you think it is. It's not always going to produce these grand answers that you may have thought. And so let's go ahead and pick up there in verse 16. And we'll read down through 18. He says, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So what are we looking at here? The writer has said, if Solomon, in his wisdom, can't figure out the meaning of life, then nobody can. Now, either if this is indeed Solomon writing, he's saying, God gave me all of this wisdom, and I've not been able to figure it out. Or if we have someone who's kind of riding under the guise of being Solomon, he's saying, you take all of his wisdom, and if you can't use that to figure it out, nothing is going to work. Now, one other thing we might add with that is he says that wisdom, as far as under the sun is concerned, the only thing good about it is it helps you to see the pain of life, but yet you can't do anything about it. Hey, so if you're trying to have this under the sun kind of wisdom, if you're trying to have some kind of wisdom without God, what he's saying is all you're going to do is you are going to see the problems of life, but you can't do a thing about it. Now, how depressing would that be? You know, you see this over here, and you know if the man would just change his ways, things would be better. And you tell him, and he says, no, this is what I'm going to do. I'm not changing anything. So the writer says, when you've got wisdom under the sun, really all it is pain. It's vexation. It's going to cause you to sit up nights worrying. It's going to cause you to see things that you can't change, do things that you know are not going to have the result that you want them to have. Again, what he's saying is, don't get caught up in your own wisdom. This is one of those warnings about your own self-righteousness. Don't get caught up in that. He's going to follow that, and he's going to say as well, I want to show you what happens when you combine this wisdom that I'm talking about with pleasure. Now, to me, this is one of the most applicable parts of the book of Ecclesiastes to our times. We'll talk about this a little bit later in the week, but let me just say kind of in preview. We live in a time that craves pleasure. You think about the multi-billion dollar industry we live in of just trying to make people happy. The writer's going to talk about that. And so let's just look and see what he says here. We're going to pick up in verse 1. We're going to read quite a bit here. Let's go on down to verse 11. And then we'll come back and make our points about it. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Listen to what he does now. Verse 4, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all those who were before me in Jerusalem. All my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all this was vanity and the striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So as he looks at this, he says, what I want to do is I want to, no holds barred with what I provide. I want everything that could possibly produce happiness, produce pleasure. And he's saying, what I'm going to do is combine that with my wisdom. And I'm going to see if I can use this pleasure to make my life good, to make my life happy under the sun. And so he hits one conclusion very early in this reading. If you look back at verse 2, he gives us kind of a preview of what's coming. He says, I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? The writer is not condemning laughing. He's not saying to us that it's wrong to laugh. What he's talking about is a meaningless kind of laugh, the fool's laughter. Here is someone who doesn't take anything seriously. Here is someone who is just bent on pleasure. Whatever he can do to make himself happy, that's what he's going to do. And the writer says to us, when I follow that path, it is just insane. It is just madness to try to follow. And so then he goes through all of these things that he provided for himself, all of these things that he's done. And as you look down through it, if indeed this is Solomon writing, we see definitely his life. You'll recall that Solomon's times were described as though gold and silver were as common as stones on the street. It was rich, prosperous. Solomon had everything. Or if this is someone writing under the guise of Solomon, he's still looking at that time. Solomon had palaces. He had concubines in number. He had wives. He had children. It talks about all of these big projects that he made for himself. Got into forestry a little bit, building these pools, watering his trees, doing all of these great things. Servants abounding all around him. Everything needed. I want to ask you something. If you took someone today and you said, would you like to live this life? What would the answer probably be? If someone were told, you can have gold and silver in abundance, and you can have palaces, and you can have servants who are going to beckon to your every call, you've only got to speak, and they're going to be there like that, and they're going to provide everything for you. How many people would turn that down? I wonder how many Christians would turn that down. Because you know what we would say? We would say, oh, I've got the wisdom to know how to use this. I understand how I'm supposed to use it. It's exactly what the writer's saying. He's saying, I have the wisdom, thought I did, to be able to keep all of this under control, to be able to use all of this. Now, what conclusion does he reach? He says, well, this unbridled consumerism, I like that idea. He says it does produce a form of happiness. Did you catch that in verse 10? He said these things did have a certain amount of happiness to them. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. It very much reminds me of what Jesus said about the prayers of the Pharisees. Remember, he says they make long prayers and they get the praise of men and that's their reward. Okay? Under the sun, the Pharisees liked getting that pat on the back. And I think in a similar fashion, he's saying, yeah, you know, I understand that there is a certain amount of happiness in having everything you want, of being able to have whatever you desire. But that's not where he stops. He says, but let's put this in the grand scheme of things. He says, let's look at this in the big picture. And in verse 11, he says, I considered all that my hands had done and all the toil that I expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and striving for the wind, and there was nothing to be gained. He said, when I try to put this in my understanding of life, it doesn't help at all. My wisdom didn't help me in any way to try to figure out how you can be happy under the sun with all of these things. Now, as I said, we'll be back to that idea. The writer's going to hit it again a couple of times as we go through. But he's laid that foundation, and he says, again, just like with wisdom, he says the experiment of control pleasure, there's nothing there. It's vanity. It's meaninglessness when you don't have God in the picture. He goes on then to say a little bit more about wisdom. He's going to talk about what's found after all of these things. Look with me to verse 12. He says, so I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. And I saw that there is more to gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is to gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Now let's stop there for a minute. He says, you know, I understand that wisdom is a good thing. I understand that the wise man has more to offer than the fool. And the wise man has his head on straight and the fool doesn't. But he doesn't stop there. Notice what he says as he goes on to verse 15. He says, then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart, this is also vanity. He says, I've been a wise man. He says, I have tried to do the right thing. But under the sun, I'm going to die just like that fool does. So here is a man who has spent his entire life trying to find wisdom, and he says, under the sun, I'm going to die just like that prostitute who has AIDS, just like that drug addict who has destroyed his body, just like the fool who has done all of these things. We're going to die the same kind of death. Under the sun. Under the sun. It's going to appear no different than if you're a fool or a wise man. It's all going to be the same. And so he's beginning to question here, what then is the purpose of this wisdom? What then is the purpose? Well, look on verse 16. It gets worse. He says, for the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies, just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after wind. He says, not only am I going to die, just like the fool does, I'm going to be forgotten, just like the fool is forgotten. You think about this. How many of you can tell me who your great-grandparents are? And now somebody might could say, yeah, I can do that. All right, let's add another great. How many of you can tell me who your great-great-grandparents are? I bet the number dwindles considerably. Why? We forget. We forget these things. And the writer is saying under the sun, if you are wise, you are going to die and be forgotten. How's that to cheer you up here on a rainy Monday morning? Now, here he's saying, if you are living only under the sun, then you can just forget about any kind of honor that's ever going to come. Death, he says, is that great equalizer. And then he says, an evaluation of your life's work. And we're kind of running a little close on time here, so let me just kind of sum this up. He says, you're going to work hard. And you're going to amass all of this stuff, and you're going to leave it to somebody else, and he may be a fool in how he uses it. You've worked so hard to build up your bank account, and your heir drains it in a week. And you can't do a thing about it. He here is what life under the sun gets you. Here is what we find. So you look at all of these things, the assessment under the sun, the experiment of wisdom, of control pleasure, the evaluation of wisdom, the evaluation of your life's work. Everything is left to someone else. You are forgotten. You are gone just like the fool is gone. Is that really how you want to live? Is that really the kind of life that you want? And so the writer is going to kind of give us a hint here. And he's going to say, let me tell you, after we've looked at all of these things, let me just show you what direction you need to be heading. And so we look down to verses 24 through 26. He says, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving for the wind. Remember, we're working our way toward the grand conclusion, but here is our first provisional conclusion. He says, as you think about all of this life, accept what God has given you as your state in life. Don't worry about trying to outdo everybody else. Don't worry about trying to amass wealth for yourself. Don't worry about trying to build this enduring reputation. Don't worry about what your heir is going to do with your wealth. Enjoy your life as it's given by God. He's not taking a very lackadaisical view of this. He's not just blowing it off. He's saying what God has given you, if you will enjoy it, knowing it's from His hand, then you start rising above the sun. Then your reasoning starts taking on a whole new level of thought. And we would say with that as well, he tells us that it's good to work, but only if it's done in cooperation with God's working. He says if the only reason for your labor is to amass wealth for yourself, you're never going to be happy. You're never going to find any meaning. But he says, if you are working at your job, your little hamster wheel, day after day, he says, if you are doing that in cooperation with how you can use that in coordination with God's purposes, you're going to find happiness. Now, that's our first glimpse at what he's working to toward the end of the book. But he's presented a very dark picture of life. Let's not miss that. He said, if you are just trying to live under the sun without God, here's what things are going to be like. But he gives us a hint, there can be something much, much better than that. Thank you for your good attention this morning. Tomorrow morning, Lord willing, we'll pick up with cycle 2, and we'll look at that second observation of life under the sun.